we're checking in on Foxconn on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In June 2018, at Foxconn's groundbreaking ceremony...
This is the eighth wonder of the world, but this is something so special. So I want to just congratulate you all. You're very special people and a very special state. Thank you very much. Thank you to Scott Walker.
President Trump declared the electronics manufacturing plant would employ 13,000 people, a $10 billion investment in Mount Pleasant. Earlier this month, Wisconsin denied Foxconn tax subsidies for failing to meet its contract obligations. What questions do you have about Foxconn's presence in Wisconsin? Do you work for Foxconn now or in the past? Tell us the experience, 800-642-1234. Josh Jezza is an investigative editor and feature writer at The Verge, covering technology, business, and climate change. His most recent reporting is on Foxconn. Josh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation this month denied Foxconn tax subsidies after it failed to create enough jobs and other things. Can you explain what disagreement you've been seeing between Foxconn and the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the primary reason that they denied Foxconn the subsidies was because Foxconn is not building the type of factory that's specified in the contract. As you mentioned, it was supposed to build a large LCD manufacturing facility that would employ 13,000 people. That's a specific type of facility called a Gen 10.5. Even at the time of the groundbreaking, Foxconn was saying that it's actually going to build a far smaller facility, a Gen 6. It's about 1/20th the size of the factory it promised. And for about a year and a half, the state has been telling Foxconn that it's not building what it promised and the contract needs to be revised. Foxconn has generally refused to revise that contract. And so earlier this month, WDC rejected Foxconn's subsidy proposal. It also found in that rejection that Foxconn had failed to employ anywhere near the number of people it would need to receive subsidies had it been building what it said it would build.
How far short was Foxconn in the hiring?
So it had to employ a minimum of 520 people. It was supposed to employ a little over 2,000. WDC found that it employed 281 people eligible under the contract.
And did you find that there was uneven ramping up of employment and then letting go of employees toward the end of the year?
I did. So both in 2018 and 2019, employees say and Foxconn's subsidy application show in a later document I obtained from the Department of Administration shows Foxconn really aggressively tried to hire enough people at the very end of the year before the subsidy deadline. A lot of these people were hired without clear roles, and many of them ended up just sitting around in the office with nothing to do. And then beginning early this year after the deadline passed, Foxconn began letting people go.
That's interesting. And so you saw that pattern there. Has Foxconn said anything about that?
Foxconn denied that it has hired people specifically to meet the subsidy quota, but the numbers are pretty clear. In the last Foxconn's headcount at the end of 2019, 60% of the people it claimed to employ were hired in the last 2 months, somewhere around 80 in the last 2 weeks. It was a very definite acceleration in its hiring at the very end of the year.
We're talking with Josh Jezza, who's an investigative editor at The Verge. He's been reporting on the status of Foxconn in Wisconsin. Taking your questions, do you work for Foxconn? Are you working at the Mount Pleasant facility? Tell us your experience. Did you work for Foxconn in the past? What was your job like and why did you leave? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. In your reporting, you interviewed 19 employees, dozens of others involved with Foxconn. You looked at public documents. What kinds of jobs did employees hired to work for Foxconn? What did they do?
That's a good question. What they ended up doing often bared little relation to what they were hired to do. So, people were hired to be recruiters or HR or business development, engineers. A lot of them ended up searching for something for Foxconn to do. It was apparent pretty quickly, as early as 2018, that the company didn't really have a plan for what to do in Wisconsin. And so employees at every level were asked to come up with a business plan. A customer in Wisconsin that would use Foxconn as a contract manufacturer, ideas that got progressively farther and farther from Foxconn's core business, like sort of a WeWork-inspired co-working operation, an aquaponic fish farm at one point, a series of business ventures that were not really the manufacturing project that Foxconn was supposed to be doing, and almost all of which ended up failing anyway.
Yeah, early on in the pandemic, we even heard that Foxconn was trying to start manufacturing ventilators with Medtronic. Did anything come of that venture?
I've been unable to confirm whether any ventilators have been produced. Neither Foxconn nor Medtronic responded to my questions. Employees weren't aware of any, officials that I spoke with weren't aware of any ventilators being produced. So it's possible they're working towards that, but I have not been able to confirm it.
With the employees you or former employees you talked with, what was their experience like working for the company? What was the environment like?
It was overwhelmingly negative. A lot of them were quite excited about the Foxconn promise, the idea of a high-tech manufacturing resurgence in Wisconsin, and were quite disappointed to discover there was no real corporate support for that plan. As time went on, the atmosphere at Foxconn became what multiple employees described as toxic, a general disrespect for the American workforce, a lot of yelling by supervisors, public humiliation of employees. It was not a good experience. It was disappointing and frustrating, were words
Employees
that a lot of people used.
having to watch the Netflix documentary American Factory.
Yes, at one point, an executive mandated everyone watch the documentary American Factory, which, if you're not familiar, is about a Chinese automotive glass company that tries to start an operation in
Ohio,
Ohio.
yeah.
And it founders and its culture clashes. American management is eventually laid off. The union push broken, and Chinese management brought in. Workers found it to be alarmingly similar to what was happening at Foxconn.
Do we know anything like what workload was like there for these employees? Like what their day entailed?
It really varied, at various points, and depending on sort of the time of year they were hired. Some employees had very little to do. They watched a lot of Netflix, took walks, things like that, if they'd been hired in one of those end of the year pushes without a clear role. Other employees were pushed to work very long hours. So particularly Foxconn had one program during that subsidy quota push that recruited foreign students on visas who would need sponsorship. Employees say it was a deliberate program because there was a sense they would work for less and be willing to relocate.
We're pausing there with Josh Jezza. We'll be back in just a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Foxconn's presence in Wisconsin here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So Foxconn is a supply chain partner of Apple and has assembled many of the world's iPhones, but not here in Wisconsin. The sprawling factory complex for LCD screens slated for Mount Pleasant has not come to fruition. But about 7,000 miles from Wisconsin, Foxconn is on a hiring blitz at its iPhone factory in Zhengzhou, processing about 2,000 applications a day. That's according to the South China Morning Post this month. What do you want to see out of Wisconsin's deal with Foxconn? What do you want to know? Join in 800-642-1234. The Verge's investigations editor, Josh Jezza, has been reporting on Foxconn, and he's our guide. Let's take a call now. Jeff is joining us from Jefferson. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I know it sounds weird, Jeff from Jefferson. my friends always say that to me. I'm calling because I'm really confused by what's going on with this. The Foxconn questions all the time, and it makes it just, it sounds like the press and everybody are really down on an organization that's not as successful as they think they should be. And the main thing I'm thinking is when our governor was running for office, it was talked about how horrible Foxconn was and the fact that this Wisconsin Economic Development was giving them money. And now suddenly I'm hearing they haven't taken any money whatsoever. And it seems like we're really, just because a business isn't as successful as they'd want to be, making them feel bad. I mean, do we attack other businesses like this? Harley closed down plants at places. Do we go after Harley Davidson or restaurants that can't stay in business during this horrible pandemic? Then these people that are trying to run businesses.
Jeff, thank you. Yeah. Are we being too critical here on Foxconn, Josh? What do you say?
So that's a good question. And I think an important point to remember is that the subsidies that were denied were one part of the subsidy package. The state and local governments have spent significant amounts of money preparing the way for the factory Foxconn said it would make. So it's at least $400 million, a lot of that in road expansion, water infrastructure,
roads,
things
plumbing,
like that.
Roads, plumbing, all of the guys, capital and infrastructure are around that area, I would assume, in the land usage.
That's right. Yeah. And in addition to that, about, you know, 80 homes were bulldozed. People were relocated to make way for this giant factory complex that Foxconn had no real plan to make. So there have been costs, even if the subsidy payments have been denied.
Have there been any reimbursements at all to that $400 million that has been spent on infrastructure? What is the status in Racine County and Mount Pleasant in particular?
So Foxconn has been making payments that it pays property taxes in Mount Pleasant, and it has been making those payments as it should. And it's important to note that Mount Pleasant is protected to a degree with its contract with Foxconn. Foxconn has to continue to pay as if it had built the factory complex that had planned. How long Foxconn will do that, whether what will happen if Foxconn does pull out is unclear, but so far Foxconn has complied with that contract.
Josh, could you give us a visual, if you would, of the Mount Pleasant complex? What has been built? What do the buildings look like? What can we see?
Yeah, so they have built their first building is a sort of warehouse-like structure called the multi-purpose building. It was empty for a while. It is sometimes used for some small manufacturing when they have something running. They were making coffee vending machines there for a while. And then you have the so-called fab, which is what was supposed to be the LCD factory that was then the smaller LCD factory and is now a building about 1 million square feet. It's unclear what it will be used for. It was recently permitted for storage. It's possible Foxconn will do some kind of last stage assembly there, but it's not on track to be an LCD manufacturing facility. According to a government report, it is more like a display demonstration facility than a viable LCD manufacturing business. And then you have the Sphere, which Foxconn had originally planned to be the network operation center for a series of data centers. It did not build the data centers and it's unclear what the sphere will be used for, potentially office and meeting space. And then another building under construction, a smaller manufacturing facility by a Foxconn subsidiary that might make circuit boards and servers at some point.
Oh, like a feeder supply chain type organization?
Yeah, it's they call it the Smart Manufacturing Center.
Okay.
The estimate I saw is that it might employ, 200 to 500 people when it's running. It would make servers and things like that.
We're talking with Josh Jezza, who's an investigations editor at The Verge. He's been reporting lately on Foxconn in Wisconsin, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Karen now in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. My question really is, before Foxconn was permitted to do this legal document with the state through the governor, there was criticism of the company, and I guess what my question is, were there red flags as looking back over this particular Foxconn business and their and how they do business with other companies? And I understand their labor practices were particularly overbearing and not respectful of workers, and so I'm wondering how much red flags did we have before this?
Mm-hmm. Did we know about this Taiwanese contract manufacturer before entering into this contract?
There were a lot of red flags. Experts said that there was a glut coming in the LCD industry that was foreseeable at the time. There were additional issues, higher labor costs, the lack of a local supply chain. Suppliers would need to relocate as well, likely with additional incentives for the factory Foxconn was proposing to work. And margins on the industry are already very thin. And so there were experts raising red flags that the thing Foxconn was promising was not likely to be a viable business. And in addition to that, Foxconn has made a lot of promises about big factories that haven't appeared. So in Brazil and Pennsylvania and Indonesia, other places, they've promised big complexes like this. They've fallen short or never appeared at all. And then, as you mentioned, a lot of people first became aware of Foxconn in the West because of the 2010 suicides at its facilities in China.
Yeah.
People were jumping off buildings, and Foxconn, in response, put up nets beneath the warehouses.
Let's bring in Regina now from Kenosha. Hi, Regina.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What is your situation with Foxconn?
I'm actually driving by the facility right now. It borders on our family farm. Luckily, we're on the other side of the freeway, so our farm didn't get demolished. It made me angry that so many people lost family farms, relocated to somewhere because our beloved leader flew over and saw farmland as empty, vacant land. It's not right. And now with all the promises being broken, with us knowing, as the last gentleman spoke out, they've not made good on their promises anywhere. I worry about groundwater contamination. Not a good situation here.
Regina, thank you for sharing what you're seeing and for your family situation that you shared. Josh, what are the environmental implications of Foxconn?
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that. There were a lot of concerns about the environmental impact of LCD manufacturing. It uses a lot of water. If there's a silver lining to all this, it's that a lot of those concerns appear unlikely to materialize because Foxconn's not on track to make LCDs. I'm not sure. I haven't really heard about concerns with, the small scale type assembly that it's doing now. So I'm not really sure what the environmental impacts of that would be, but the groundwater contamination and other effects, potential effects of LCD manufacturing appear at this time unlikely to happen.
So at this point, what are you watching for out of Foxconn in Wisconsin?
I'm really unsure what the company is going to do. Terry Goh, the founder, issued a statement after the story saying that Foxconn would, I'm paraphrasing, but be a partner to places that were a good partner to Foxconn and be committed to Wisconsin if Wisconsin was committed to Foxconn. You know, it mentions working closely with Trump several times. It's unclear to me what the company will do after the election, depending on how that goes, whether it stays or runs a small-scale manufacturing operation or leaves. I don't know.
Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Jezza is an investigations editor and feature writer at The Verge, covering Foxconn most recently. Coming up, we continue our series of Canada conversations with U.S. Representative Gwen Moore. That's after a news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we continue our candidate conversations leading up to Election Day. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republican Tim Rogers is challenging 8-term U.S. Representative Gwen Moore, a Democrat in the 4th Congressional District. The independent Robert Raymond declined our invitation. We spoke with Tim Rogers last week. Do you live in Milwaukee, Brown Deer, Shorewood, or another community in the 4th District? What issues are driving you to the polls? What do you want to ask Congresswoman Gwen Moore? We're at 800-642-1234. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Milwaukee has served in Congress since 2004. She's seeking her 9th term and is a member of the House Ways and Means Committee. Representative Moore, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Good morning, everyone.
So our massive upsurge in cases is among the worst in the nation. Hospitalizations here of COVID have more than doubled in the last month, 86% of ICU beds in use. What are you doing to help Wisconsinites weather this crisis?
Oh, Kate, this is such a nightmare. I have family members who are sick and have underlying conditions, and so I'm very terrified. What we have tried to do as a majority in the House of Representatives is to pass another pandemic package, really to incentivize people to stay at home, to get tested, to be treated, and to reduce some of the insecurity that they're feeling. You know, the census now retired census did a weekly survey, and they did one during July and found that like 29 million people were food insecure, that they were depressed, drinking more, having suicidal ideations. So it's not just the pandemic. It's the underlying economic despair and other things that are having a real impact on other folks. We have really, our leader, Nancy Pelosi, has done a phenomenal job trying to negotiate. And one of the things that the Republicans have resisted, and the president has resisted, is to provide aid to state and local governments. And that would include monies for our schools. You know, it's sort of ironic to say that you want people to get back to work, you want kids to get back to school, but you aren't providing one square foot of plexiglass for these classrooms. Not one visit from mechanics to fix the ventilation systems in our older school structures. And so we're working really hard to try to do that.
Well,
Kate,
let me ask you this, because Democrats, Republicans, and the White House have been unable to reach a deal on the second stimulus for months, and talks have been largely put off ahead of Election Day. Senate's adjourned till the 9th. Why can't Democrats strike a deal when Americans and Wisconsinites are in dire straits? Why can't Democrats make some compromise?
that compromise is the name of the game. But what should that compromise look like? What Republicans are putting forward are initiatives to help larger businesses with the PPP. They want liability from the coronavirus a pandemic for these larger companies. They want the benefit to inure to the top corporations, and they're resisting providing funding for state and local governments. You know, every time we talk about enhancing the child tax credit or providing more money for the Women, Infant, and Children's Program, the WIC program, or food stamps, we're accused of trying to pork up the bill for a wish list of Democratic dreams. I don't think food is a wish list when we have, as of in July, and it's worse now, people saying that they're food insecure. Kate, there are people who haven't paid rent since July, and all of the provisions in the first CARES Act to provide people with relief from being evicted have expired.
Expired, right. Literally
have nightmares every night about being evicted.
Well, let me ask you this, because Senator Democrats, they blocked the $500 billion Republican coronavirus relief bill last week. And you mentioned the more money for PPP, a $300 per week supplemental unemployment insurance benefit, liability protections for businesses, as you mentioned. It did not include another round of direct payments to people. Is it the stimulus checks that are the sticking point? What piece of this next stimulus is causing the greatest divide?
Well, listen, let me back up a little bit, Kate. What is really holding it up is, what will Donald Trump sign? Mitch McConnell has taken himself out of the mix because he doesn't want to put himself out there and make a commitment and negotiate in good faith, knowing how mercurial the president is and what will he sign. Also, he's got at least 20 of his senators who don't want to do anything with regard to providing people more stimulus. Now, you look at that $300 unemployment insurance that they want to provide. That really taxes really closely to the minimum wage. So one of the sticking points is that we initially gave people $600 a week for unemployment insurance. And, you know, Republicans, in their stinginess, they've decided that they don't want to initiate any moral hazard by spoiling people who might get, you know, a couple of pennies over the minimum wage. And again, it's state and local government. The $500 billion is nowhere close to the $3 trillion bill that was initially put forward by our caucus, really tracking closely with what the needs were, including more PPP and to save jobs. We went down. We cut $1 trillion off of that immediately. $500 billion is nowhere close to meeting the needs. Who do you throw under the bus, Kate? Who goes under the bus when you cut it? When you cut the bone and sinew and muscle out of a bill, and you know, it's like your children. You know, which one are you not going to feed tonight as you're cutting the budget?
Well, let me reintroduce you. Gwen Moore is a Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th District running for re-election. The district includes parts of the Milwaukee metro region, and we're doing candidate conversations leading up to Election Day, taking your questions. If you live in the 4th Congressional District, what do you want to tell Congresswoman Moore? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom. What's on your mind?
You're absolutely right. It'll take $3 or $4 trillion to get our economy going, and these people are standing in the way. It's just not right. Anyway, I studied economics at Georgetown. They don't understand that. But anyway, I wanted to ask this question about these figures come out of the administration's unemployment figures, the Commerce Department. They're all bringing out these spectacular figures, and In your experience, have you found that a month or two later that they revise them downward when it comes out that they're really not actual factual figures? And I'd also like to ask, how can you talk to these people who don't want to vote? What do you say to get them excited to get out there and vote? We've made it so complicated. Here in Burlington, you can't send a letter that it's got to go to Milwaukee and then get postmarked and then come back here to go a block away to the clerk's office.
Okay, Tom, thank you. And two quite different questions there for you.
Oh,
go ahead.
They're good questions, though. You know, you're really spot on, Tom, with your economic analysis. It drives me nuts to hear the president talk about how we've got the lowest unemployment rate among African Americans and the lowest unemployment rate, you know, among Hispanics. I mean, when you start from zero, when you start from rock bottom, any number is an improvement with the unemployment numbers rising. When you talk about someone having three, I once had a witness, a Hispanic woman. She had two jobs. Her husband had two jobs. You know, they had four jobs trying to support their families. And that's what Donald Trump calls increase in unemployment. It's when people cobble together all of these sub-minimum wage jobs, sub-par wages. And the second part of the question is very difficult to convince people who are determined not to vote to vote. I think that the success of the Russian trolling and the interference and the lack of integrity around some social media has really confused people. And I think people are getting double messages. I think we at some point we need to do major campaign reform. Every station is not public radio, Tom, where you hear both sides, where you get just the facts, where there's fact checking, and where people don't have an agenda. It's very, very difficult. What I've said to young people in particular, since that is the cohort in Wisconsin that really is going to tip whether or not whether or not we elect Joe Biden here or not, is that, you know, the person who signed your birth certificate is an elected official, and the person who's going to sign your death certificate is an elected official. And everything that happens between that little dash is a decision that's made by someone who is in public office. So you need to participate. Everything from how much your vehicle registration fee is going to cost, whether or not Foxconn gets funded by your tax dollars, whether or not you'll be able to access birth control, for God's sake, much less an abortion. How about birth control? So I just want people to know that if you want agency over your life, you just really have to vote.
We are in the midst of candidate conversations leading up to Election Day. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore is running for re-election in the 4th Congressional District. We spoke with her Republican challenger, Tim Rogers, last week. The district covers the city of Milwaukee and area suburbs. Are you an undecided voter in the 4th? What do you need to know before casting your ballot? What should Congress be laser focused on amid the pandemic? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Congresswoman Gwen Moore here on the Ideas Network. It's candidate conversations leading up to the November general election on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Democratic incumbent U.S. Representative Gwen Moore as we focus on the 4th congressional district race. And Congresswoman Gwen Moore stays with us for 10 more minutes. You know, I want to zero in on Milwaukee. COVID case numbers in Milwaukee County are close to 41,000. There's a new health order in Milwaukee. Bars and restaurants are on the cusp of closure. What do you think the federal government should be doing to bring the pandemic under control? And specifically, what can you do about what Milwaukee is seeing?
Oh, let me tell you, our governor has been under siege from Republican legislators. You know, I consider them to be mobs of people, not true militias, demanding that they have their quote-unquote freedom to infect everyone by not wearing masks. You know, the science is very clear. that wearing masks really reduces infection rates by 50%. I mean, that's pretty, that's a pretty substantial number. I mean, if you they have a 50-50 chance of not catching it by merely wearing a mask. And, you know, it's a, such a small sacrifice to make.
Should the government be, should the government be mandating masks in public spaces?
Well, it's a matter of public health. I mean, people have invented these rights, Kate Archer. I mean, I have never interpreted the First Amendment as being able to contravene other people's rights. You know, you have a right. And I have a right, too. I have a right not to be infected because of your inconsideration. Sure. And not only should they mandate it, but I think that we ought to provide masks for people. It's an expense. People shouldn't have to go to Amazon.com to get masks. We ought to be providing them based on the numbers of households. And in countries where people have had a unified activity, they have brought the numbers down, they've been able to keep their businesses open, and they've been able to put children back to school. And to the extent that we have this patchwork quilt effort, you know, where some cities, you know, like Milwaukee, we try to do the right thing, but outlying areas are going to act like they're in the Wild Wild West and have some some fantasized freedom to infect everyone. It really, really, and of course the virus doesn't have any boundaries. It can cross any kind of border boundary, and that's what happens. I just really, really want people to take this seriously. We don't want to shut the economy down. We want to get it back on track. But Kate, you know, if we had more time, I could walk you through January 28th when the president first learned about the virus.
I want to switch gears here and ask you about lead poisoning, big problem in your district. And we learned this month that the rates of lead testing for children have dropped during the pandemic. What is going on there?
25,000 children a year are poisoned by lead. You know, it's a low priority. Not locally, not statewide, but nationally. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm not off mark when I say that we only put about $1 for every $10 that's really needed to do a national strategy around replacing lead laterals, lead piping. We can't put all the burden on landlords because that would inflate rents beyond what people could afford. This has got to be a national priority. And in fact, in this last appropriations bill, I did put money in specifically to deal with replacing lead laterals. I think that the replacing lead laterals along with some sort of work program would really, really enable people to, number one, have training, have jobs. It would reduce the cost in addition to solving a really, really dangerous health hazard.
I mean, we talked with Public Works not long ago saying it's going to take more than two generations to change out those lead service lines. You know, what can we do to make sure that stays on track or that could be expedited?
Well, again, two generations, and that's what I said, that if you had, that's on a quote-unquote normal trajectory. You have to prioritize this. You have to put some sort of training program in so that you can contain the costs and use local talent, something like the WPA, quite frankly, and make it an emergency work project. And put the federal resources in. I see a lot of people on the local level complaining about what the governor has or has not done, what the mayor has or has not done, but we need money. And even before I put this last initiative into the appropriations bill, I'd worked with the late, great Louise Slaughter to reinforce and shore up our two sources of water bills. But again, it's only a drop in the bucket, pun intended, I guess, in terms of what we really, really need to deal with this. And this is not just, you know, it drives me nuts to hear people talk about Flint, Michigan, because our numbers are right on track with the numbers of children who are poisoned from lead, as is the case in Flint. Flint had an entirely different situation with regard to what I regard is irresponsible and even criminal behavior on a part of elected officials. But when you look at the numbers of children who are impacted, it's similar. And, of course, this causes permanent brain damage. There's some research that says it causes violence. When you look at our prison population, you will see an eerie connection between lead poisoning and people who have become violent. And so this is a public health problem, and it needs to be treated like an emergency so that you can provide the funding that you need so that you can speed up the response. And not have it be two generations away. We can't afford that.
Talking with Gwen Moore, Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 4th District running for re-election. We're having our candidate conversations leading up to Election Day. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. I want to land on racial injustice and what we saw over the summer in the protests and the ways to address racial injustice and the Black Lives Matter movement. What must happen in this discussion to make sure that this doesn't get swept under and just, you know, go away? What do you need to do at the federal level and the state level?
Kate, thanks for asking that question. You know, I think the most important thing that we need to do has already been done, and that is to raise people's consciousness about it. You know, unfortunately, the entire world saw the George Floyd death. And so you just couldn't deny what happened, because all of us, you know, all of us want to see our police officers be safe. All of us realize they have a really hard job. But when you look at that, you have to ask your question. You have to ask questions, you know, about being responsible. I mean, the man was already George Floyd was already under control and just didn't need him to that excessive force is something that we need to deal with. We have a Justice and Policing Act that the Black Caucus put together, and it wasn't something thrown together overnight. It's the experience of generations of Black people. You know, number one, holding police accountable with making sure that they don't just have qualified immunity, that just because they're police officers, you automatically don't look at their behavior, that you change police misconduct statutes so that that they're held accountable. I'm looking at, thinking of Breonna Taylor. Mm-hmm. No-knock warrants. I mean, they just aren't necessary. They weren't necessary to burst into this young. And maybe the police officers who did that, they say they were doing their job. But my God, why were they there? What had she done that caused them to burst into her home in the middle of the night? So I think that on the federal level, we need to pass the Justice and Policing Act. I think we can get police to come to the table and help us hammer out the best provisions to protect them. And I think we need to do stuff on the state level as well.
Congresswoman Moore, thank you for joining us.
And thank you, and have a good morning. Everybody stay safe, sanitized, sane, and be sure to go and vote.
And that is Gwen Moore on the Ideas Network.